It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Jim Dalrymple from The Loop is here, as well as Andy Iannocco and Renee Ritchie's triumphant return from CES. We'll talk about Apple at CES, their privacy play, and why health services might be the most important thing Apple's got up its sleeve. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 644, recorded Tuesday, January 15th, 2019. Shlomo, Guillermo, and Alyosha. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Grammarly. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently by going to Grammarly.com/MacBreak and get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today. And by LastPass. Make password management a priority in 2019. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business and reduce the threat of breach at LastPass.com/TWiT. Oh, and we'll be at the LastPass cocktail party at RSA. Come by and see us. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com to find out which Atlassian tools are right for your team and give their products a try for free. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. Joining us from The Loop, loopinsight.com, the famous, the world famous Jim Dalrymple. Hello, Jim.
How you doing, Leo?
I am great. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I miss you.
Yeah. Looks like the beard's in fine fettle.
Oh, you know, it's going strong. Nothing I can do about it.
Great to have you. Your ears were probably burning because I've been talking about iTunes Match and the problems you had a couple of years back with Apple's music matching and so forth. It's all better now, right?
Pretty much.
Okay, there you go. You have it.
There's topic two today.
There's the view from the front. Also with us, Mr. Andrew Iannocco of WGBH in Boston Public Radio. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. In honor of Jim, I did not shave today, so I don't have a beard.
You got a way to go.
I have solidarity, like chin stuff.
You got a way to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you got a month or two.
Between this, my sideburns and Jim's everything else, we've got real like Civil War, like Northern General stuff going on.
I'm the only one on the panel without any facial hair. I feel really left out because Renee Ritchie's back. We missed you, Renee. And so
I missed you guys too.
Yeah.
I had to go. I had an unexpected CES experience.
Yeah. So how did that happen?
My boss kept saying, you don't have to go, you don't have to go, you don't have to go. And then like 2 days before, he's like, remember when I said you don't have to go?
You have to go.
I was kind of wrong. You have to go.
Was it worth it? What was did Apple actually had a little bit of a presence at CES?
Yeah, with all the, I mean, sure, we're going to talk about it, with all the AirPlay 2 and HomeKit and iTunes for Tizen. I mean, let that sink in for a moment.
iTunes for Tizen.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. They were the big talk of the show. Last year, there was a lot of condemnation for them not being there, not having any presence, letting Google Home and Alexa steal the show. And this year, Samsung put out their announcement the Sunday before the show, and they got just a ton of attention for the rest of the week because it kept being like, and another TV set company, and another TV set company.
So
and
Apple
they did much better prepared.
Apple did. At first, we thought Apple's only presence would be that big billboard on the side of the Marriott. Hotel there that said
priceless.
What happens on the iPhone stays on the iPhone. A great lesson in snark, according to CNET. And of course, the whole point of that is while everything else at CES is spying on you, we're not.
Yeah.
You like that, Jim?
I mean,
I did like that. I thought that was a brilliant marketing campaign going into CES, considering, you know, the other companies that were going to be there.
Yeah. Particularly Google Assistant and Amazon's Echo, yeah.
Yeah, when you think about it, what better way to fight the competition than boost the thing that you put out there the most, which is privacy for Apple, and the thing that other companies put out there the least?
I was talking on Friday with
on Triangulation with Shoshana Zuboff. She's written a new book called Surveillance Capitalism. She says, invented by Google, perfected by Facebook. But she gave Apple a pass. She said, I asked her about this. She said, really, it's a big opportunity for Apple. So if people want to use technology, because technology doesn't mean surveillance, but if they want to use technology without having the company collect data about them and then try to influence them with that data, Apple seems like they're well positioned to do that. That would be a real opportunity for them. And it seems like they know that.
Can I give you a great example, Leo?
Yeah.
So like Apple also got their act together with HomeKit this year, and they worked with a bunch of providers to get really good products like door locks and doorbells and all these camera systems that also have options not to share your data with anybody. And that came into really good focus a couple of days in.
Ring.
First the Information and then The Intercept, broke that story about Ring. And that really, I know for a lot, especially a lot of people at the show, that gave them sort of an instant different take on almost all of the gadgets that were putting all your stuff into these companies' hands all the time. And companies you didn't always know, like they were just a product name. You didn't necessarily know who owned them or where the data was.
And I'll mention this story because Ring was a long time sponsor of our shows. The Ring doorbell was purchased by Amazon. Amazon says they're not doing this. Ring wasn't clear whether they'd done it in the past. A couple of years ago, I think it was 2016, Ring wanted, apparently, according to this is the story from The Intercept, Sam Biddle, who I don't completely trust. You said The Information also had this. I trust
The Information had it earlier in December, and they listed, like, they're very good at disclosing, and they said, we have 24 sources who said this. We have company documents. We have their PowerPoint presentations.
Okay, that's
pretty
good.
We have their investor notes.
So in order to get face recognition into their device, this is not an unusual practice. They needed it to be trained. Actually, object recognition. They needed it to be trained, and so they sent it to contractors in Ukraine, who would then circle. That's a face. That's a package. That's a tree. According to the story, they basically gave them access to an S3 bucket that had everybody's video from every Ring device. Ostensibly for the training, but it also meant that those people could download it, share it,
without due caution, without due protection. This is how these things almost always happen. It's never that cavalier, but it's just as devastating. Where they say, "Oh, we just need to train our system to learn about what a dog looks like," but it doesn't occur to them that maybe this training should be happening inside a locked box with all kinds of controls over who gets access to this video and what they can do with it. But no, unless your company is really built from the ground up with the idea that security and privacy is one of our foundational and fundamental tenets, this is the sort of thing that happens. That's the difference between a company like Apple and everybody else, and then to a lesser extent, a company like Google and a company like Facebook. Remember that the uprising from employees could not shut down the project to create a search engine for China. Outrage from governments could not could not turn down that project. Pressure from human rights people cannot do that. But as soon as they violated internal privacy protocols, say that you did not come to our department for permission to scrape this data from this Google owned China launch page, you are getting shut down right now. You have no access to any of the data you need. But it's shocking, though, isn't it, that the only thing that stops these things from happening is the goodwill or the good intentions or the good dogma, in Apple's case, of a company. That there are no, in the United States, there are just no protections whatsoever. All you got to do is say, sorry. And then maybe you have to send a nice note to the shareholders for the stock dive. But there's no consequences whatsoever, and that needs to change.
And it's it's almost never malicious. Sometimes it's almost never malicious, but it's just expediency. They wanted this done, and they have but they also had a database that they could go find the email address and then put that email address in and watch that specific camera. And because there was no one supervising any of it, guess what they did? I mean, it's just trouble all the way down.
I still have a Ring doorbell, and I don't really much care if somebody looks at what's on outside my house. But I guess Ring also, I didn't realize this, had inside cameras.
Yeah, it was the internal cameras too. And they said people were walking by with were watching people kissing and having conversations.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
this is why I wonder when Apple is going to do their own like home security or home like home monitoring service. That's going to be a killer thing. If there's one thing that could get me to switch a certain platform to Apple, it would be if they would decide if I get the functionality of my Google backed internal cameras, which are really useful for me because sometimes I just need to check what's going on outside, or sometimes when I leave, I really do want to have a camera going on inside my office to make sure that nobody is stealing a $5,000 thing that's on loan to me that I'm going to have to pay for. But I, even with Google, a company that I trust with conditions, I keep that camera turned off when I don't need a security thing. If Apple decided to do this, I mean, you guys are absolutely right. When it comes to privacy and security, this really is hardwired into the DNA of the company. And I would implicitly, instinctively trust that not only do they as a company, are they as a company not going to abuse this data, but they're going to make sure that no one else can abuse it either. So this would be a huge opportunity for Apple.
Neither Amazon nor Ring responded to the information's request, although according to The Intercept, a Ring spokesperson said it's not happening now, but he did not
address whether it happened in the past.
Yeah.
I got a comment from because I put up a video about it. I used those as examples for why we need both regulation about privacy for companies and also protection from the government from these companies, but also protection from the government, like basically a right for privacy. And I got a very polite 2-paragraph statement from them basically saying that they take privacy very, very seriously and they have strict policies in place. But as numerous people pointed out, this was all forward-looking stuff. It didn't really address anything specific. Yeah. In the past.
Are they changing the terms of service to say that now it is an explicit opt-in to allow the company access to data for training purposes, both humans and robots? Or is it now simply, this is one of the things you blow past when you're trying to get this thing installed?
That's in the EULA.
Yeah.
Green.
I think a lot of this stuff, not just from Ring, but for all of these companies that are looking at AI and machine learning and all of that, they're so focused on the technology, they tend to forget about all of the privacy aspects of what they're doing. And I agree with Rene, a lot, this isn't necessarily malicious, but the end result is basically the same.
I don't think it's malicious, but it is sloppy.
Yeah.
It's right, exactly. It's the interests of a company superseding what the interests of the user are. And it's a complicated problem in medicine too. The thing is, the more data that medical algorithms get access to, the better these things are going to be at discovering diseases and discovering problems early on, or correctly or reducing the cost and increasing the access of medicine. However, privacy now, medical information is one area in which we do have laws protecting what information can be sent elsewhere and why and how consent has to be performed and explicitly in order for this sort of happen. So it's odd that it's odd that we are being protected very rightly our privacy for medical information, but this is also making delaying the access to medical technology that could potentially save a lot of lives in the future. But that's you have to make a decision.
It's also the same week that we found out $300 could get a bounty hunter or debt collector access to your exact location from
AT&T.
All the carriers.
T-Mobile. Yeah. Verizon had done it before and got caught, so they weren't they weren't available. Apple has taken measures, I think, that are interesting. You're getting some sense they maybe care. They hired this week a former Facebook employee, Sandy Perakulis, who had left Facebook in 2012 and has been very critical over its privacy policies since then. According to Financial Times, Perakulis will work at Apple's privacy team as a product manager, which is an internal facing role designed to, and I love this, to ensure that new products in development protect users' privacy and minimize data collection. That's, I think, a strong signal that Apple cares about this.
they have a really cool approach. Like previously there was like the performance team and the security team who could like literally take away your code and say, no, you're not shipping this until you fix it or we fix it or somebody fixes it. And they've added a privacy team, and the privacy team starts when you have, like with Face ID, it starts when you have the idea for Face ID. It's not like develop Face ID, then we'll figure out how to make it private. It's no, you can't do this until it's private. Okay, you've done that. Now you can't do this until, and each step along the way, they have to figure out how to collect the minimum amount of data possible, how to encrypt it, how to anonymize it, how to get rid of it as fast as possible, and in the end, ultimately make a product that passes Apple's privacy criteria. And they're involved every step of the way along the process. And they have like these teams, including individuals like him, who sit down with the engineers and with the engineering managers and figure out how to do it.
Tim Cook, in his interview with Axios last November, said that privacy is a core value. If you look back over time, we were talking about privacy well before iPhone. So we've always believed that privacy was at the core of our civil liberties. It's not a matter of privacy versus profits or privacy versus technical innovation. That's a false choice. What we've done is your device has incredible intelligence about you, but I don't have to have all of that as a company. Now, okay, here's a tough question, though. Some say, yeah, Apple pays lip service to this. It's good marketing, but do they really do it?
I think they do. They really do it because a lot of the information that we try and send to Apple, like through Siri. Siri could be a much more intuitive product if Apple would collect.
That's the proof. Siri sucks.
All of that data.
Do you think they would do that on purpose, Leo?
that should have been like the second billboard. If they had another wall billboard available for purchase, look how bad Siri is compared to everything else on the market. That means you can trust us.
I mean, Siri can do things inside of your iPhone or your iPad. But if Siri collected more data and looked ahead more like some of the other products out there, then
that's a good data point. I agree. What about China, though? I mean, Apple has been very cooperative with the Chinese government. In fact, iCloud data in China is stored on Chinese servers.
So I asked about that because that, you know, I talk about this stuff quite a lot and I always want to make sure I know what I'm talking about. And it's hard for people outside China to think about life in China because for China, it's our citizens have data and we'll be damned if that data gets stored on American servers. That's data for Chinese
completely
people.
Completely reasonable, by the way.
It has to be stored on Chinese. Yeah, and France wants this too. And, you know, the U.S. doesn't want U.S. telecommunications to go through Huawei infrastructure.
But we know that
either.
China, the Chinese government has in the past, in the case of Yahoo, used information collected by tech companies to prosecute.
Apple has the keys.
Yeah.
Like there's no difference architecturally between how iCloud works in China and how iCloud works in
America. So the Chinese
America.
Government doesn't have access to that data without
no,
some sort of
legal process.
No, the danger
is it's so much closer that they could force their way in and use legal compulsions that would take weeks or months to get done in the U.S. They can do them there. But if that happens, then I think Apple will have to make a bigger decision about China. But for now, it's repatriation.
It's still problematic. It's the only reason why Apple is the company you can trust the most in terms of taking security and privacy seriously. That's why I twitch a little when I see as big a flex as the statement that what happens on your phone, on your iPhone, stays on your iPhone, because I don't think that they can. I don't think they can. They have really earned the ability to be that. I don't want to use the word arrogant again about it. I'm looking for something two notches below arrogant.
Cocky.
Because as they have a similarity with Google and Facebook in that they know where their money is coming from and they're willing to flex on something that doesn't really affect their own bottom line at all. What if one of the best things they could do to help user privacy is to say, well, guess what? We're no longer going to be taking any money from Google to be use Google as the default search engine. Our default search engine is going to be DuckDuckGo. Because we love their privacy protections, and also we know that the one of the most helpful things we could possibly do for DuckDuckGo is to make it the default search engine for the most popular mobile platform. One of the most popular mobile platforms in the world, but they don't do that. And they could also make the Safari browser make more proactive in protecting people against trackers, but they don't really do that either. That's not saying that they're hypocrites at all, but that's when you, it's a difference between saying we are proud of our respect for the privacy of our users and saying a big billboard facing everybody at CES saying what happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone. Well, depends on what country you're in and depends on what you're doing with it. And we'll still let certain apps on the App Store that maybe are still gonna tell you that
Shoshana said, I said, do you use a smartphone? She said, yeah, I use an iPhone, but I don't put any apps on it. Because that is the case. If you put the Facebook app on an iPhone,
right,
what happens on your iPhone does not stay on your iPhone with regards to the Facebook app, including location information that you allow Facebook to collect.
The way that that users interact with other companies or other apps, Apple can't control that. Yeah. I mean, and they're not a charity. They do, you know, they're out there to make some money, but keep users' privacy as one of their main objectives.
Well, and they can argue that it's a user's choice. I mean, I don't have Facebook on my iPhone. That's up to you.
I'm not saying they're hypocrites. I'm not saying that they're in any way like a terrible at security and privacy. Again, they are the apps, not only the best, they are the standard, I think, that all other companies should emulate. However, when they do something as explicit like that, I'm the jerk in the back of the room who coughs and raises his hand and saying, can you clarify your position on this? I would love to hear Tim Cook at some point post a letter simply saying that there is a line that we're not willing to cross when it comes to helping governments do bad things to their own citizens. Like if there were if the government of any country wanted the iPhone to have a kill switch for certain types of conversation. Let's say they passed an actual law in the country saying that every phone in the country has to do all of its text messaging through the standardized text messaging app that we can actually take a look at if we need to. They can, we're not allowing VPNs, which is something that's already happened in China, but we're also not allowing encrypted chat applications. I would love Tim Cook to say, we have a duty to say that if a government crosses an ethical line in our estimation, we will simply turn our back on that market. We will not simply decide that a market is so valuable to us that we are willing to let the iPhone become a tool of oppression, which is very, very possible in so much of the world.
We're talking
so far historically, Dave.
We're talking slight differences here. I mean, if I put a Google phone next to the iPhone, if that's the choice, well, it's clear this is more private. Maybe
absolutely.
Not perfect, but the iPhone's clearly more private than any Android.
There's also line where they like, for example, they prefer to stay engaged in everything. Apple always believes that engagement is the best way to elicit change. And if they pull out completely, then they no longer have an effective platform to which to promote the change that they want. So they'll do a certain amount. Like, for example, they still want to provide backup services to Chinese customers because they believe they promised them that. And that's fail safe, not fail secure. And you can argue about which is better for which customer. But they believe that by pulling out completely from China, they'd no longer be able to offer things like preserving your photos of your children and things like that. But they've also shown with San Bernardino that there is a line where they believe if it's not legal and it's not ethical, they will fight for it. We don't know what will happen if they lose ever. Like, we'll see what happens with Australia now with some of their laws, or maybe in the EU when they pass their laws. But they've shown a willingness to at least engage in incredibly public fisticuffs over things that they find unethical.
And let's point out that human rights groups have said exactly the same thing, that if you mostly in terms of what Google wants to do in China, but saying that although it's a complex issue, we do believe that it's better to give people access to tools that might improve their lives and hope that it doesn't get compromised and maybe pull them back later, than to simply preemptively decide that no, we're just not going to participate whatsoever. So
FaceTime was pulled in the Emirates when they were having issues with it. They would rather not provide the service than provide it compromised. They just pulled the FaceTime app.
You know, it's interesting because in this, I learned a lot in this book, Surveillance Capitalism. But she quotes Larry Page and Sergey Brin in their early paper about Google in the late 90s, in which they said, we'll never do advertising because advertising ultimately, however much you try to isolate it, will impact the result of search. But what happened is the dot-com bust, and their investors in 2000 and 2001 came to them and said, you guys have to do something to monetize. This is not tenable. And Google flipped and said, we're going to do advertising. Yeah. And in order to do advertising better, we're going to collect all of this data we have about, you know, people are, we have a browser. We know a lot about what people do, not just what they search for, but what they do. And we're going to, instead of throwing that away, we're going to start using that. Initially, they used it for advertising, but then Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg left Google, went to Facebook. Facebook realized, oh, this is more than just targeting ads. You can use this to initially to predict behavior and ultimately to affect behavior. She yep. points out that Facebook, in its they called them the contagion studies. You may remember a couple of these. One, Facebook tried to influence your mood by yeah. changing what was in your news feed and proved it
Make
could be
sad.
Done.
Yeah.
In fact, they gave a paper saying, look, we could do this.
Yeah.
And Facebook, at that man. Point, now it's not just the trade-off you're making is not just for better advertising, which to me is a worthwhile trade-off, but they're in fact able to influence you. And yep. that starts to get problematic, obviously. I don't know how perfectly they'll be able to do that.
Again, we need some sort of legislative protections. One company that never gets brought up in these conversations, and I think they're one of the most dangerous, potentially one of the most dangerous companies of all, is Amazon. Because the whole benefit of collecting data for advertising purposes, if you want to sell how good your ad network is you tell the tire company that, no, not only are we going to give your ad and put your ad in front of a million people that suit the people you're asking for, but here's our data on how many people actually see one of these ads and then go through to an actual sale of that product. Amazon is the one company that can not only track what they track everything. If you just had a casual interest in a folding bicycle, they can track all the searches you did within Amazon, all the different products you looked at, track the level of your interest as it waxed and waned, track your interest in certain price levels and certain feature levels, compare that to the history of the things you bought over the past 10 years, all the way down from chocolate chip morsels to an iMac, and then basically tell you, no, we know that Andy Notko is going to be ripe to buy a folding bicycle on February 8th, 2019, and we're offering to the highest bidder someone a series of ads that will target Andy for a folding bicycle. If there's one company that is really ready to have the antitrust hammer brought down on them, I think that Amazon has to be one of those final two or three candidates in the pageant.
That's part of the problem, though, is that you can have a private iPhone, a private Apple stuff, but you're gonna use it to buy stuff on Amazon. You're gonna use it yeah. to
I'm gonna email somebody using Gmail, and yeah. they'll have my email anyway.
Yeah.
Amazon
is in a very unique position, though, and Andy's absolutely right about Amazon. But the way that the public looks at Amazon is for convenience yeah. and for shopping. So we're willing to go in there, with an Amazon Prime subscription, get free shipping. And Amazon, you know, gives us all of this stuff, you know, music and video and all of that kind of stuff with Prime. But they're getting so much information from us because we continue to buy there yeah. all the time. And as a consumer, it's very easy. You can order off of Amazon anywhere, and you can basically order anything you want. I mean, I order firewood sticks from Amazon, you know, yep. to light fires.
Really?
With.
You buy your firewood on Amazon?
No, you know, the little sticks.
Oh, yeah, the fatwood. Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
kindling.
Yeah.
Right. Fatwood. I ordered that off of Amazon now, because if you bought a cord, deliver a big box and it's done, you know.
So if you bought a cord of firewood on Amazon, then I'd be impressed.
Yeah. They have a lumberjack network, Leo. What are you talking about? They come in their plaid jacket
in the yeah. driveway.
See, yeah,
but,
I mean,
but
Jim,
we tend to trust ahead. Amazon as a brand,
right.
like we trust Apple as a brand, but the differences are remarkable in how they use our information.
I think yeah. it's important, and I think we can do this, that we continue to tell Apple, because I think most users probably aren't really that aware of it and care that much. But I think it's important that we who do care really keep telling Apple, yes, this is good. Keep doing this. Yep. Keep your eye on the ball, because at some point it may be that the investors or the shareholders say, you got to make more money, you know, as their revenue drops on iPhones. You got to make more money. You should really start doing, you know, they tried iAds, remember? I mean, that would have had some sort of trade-off of privacy for advertising. That they don't move down that road. That they understand there's real value to them as a company to preserve yeah. privacy as their core value.
As we've said once or twice before, it's all about the transaction. Some people, I'm comfortable with the transaction I'm making with Google, given the quality of the apps and services and now the hardware that they give me. And I'd like to think that I'm aware of what I'm giving them in response. Some people are not comfortable with that transaction. That's perfectly fine. I'm not comfortable with the transaction I make with Facebook. So I limit my exposure to Facebook to the minimum thing possible, which means that I'll like log in and check like on the web app Messenger saying, oh, wow. Remember that week that I was feeling really lonely because no one like wanted to invite me to Christmas parties? Here are like 8 messages on Messenger saying, yo, Andy, I'm having a Christmas party in 2 days. Why don't you come over? Like,
whoops. Okay, where are you,
sorry.
Andy?
Sorry. It's January 2nd and I don't have the Messenger app on my phone. So,
yeah. Andy, blink twice if Christmas. You need rescue.
I've got a Facebook portal I'll be glad to send you, Andy, if you want to really keep up with the friends and. So there is good news. A judge has now ruled, a federal judge, district court judge, has now ruled that the feds, even with a warrant, cannot force you to unlock your phone with your finger or your face. This is a huge, huge ruling. And I don't know how I'm not sure what will happen here. The order came from U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. They denied a search warrant for a property in Oakland. The warrant included all the phones, any phone on the premises, and the ability to unlock them with facial recognition, a fingerprint, or an iris. In the past, we've just kind of said off the cuff that courts seem to support the ability to use biometrics to unlock, but not the use of passwords.
Because it wasn't testimony. Passwords were testimony, but biometrics weren't.
The judge, and I think this really recognizes the significant role that a phone plays in your life. The judge, Candace Westmore, ruled the request was overbroad because it wasn't limited to a particular person or a particular device. The judge said the government does not have the right, even with a warrant, to force suspects to incriminate themselves by unlocking their devices with their biological features. This is a very surprising and I think a big deal ruling. Yeah.
It's a foundational thing. Again, do you have the ability to keep a secret from the government? This isn't the big rule that I'm hoping to see in my lifetime, but it is a big deal to say that if you've encrypted a phone, if you've locked a phone, you can't be compelled to unlock it. The government can take the phone and try to unlock it themselves, but they can't compel you to unlock it. If this holds, and remember, and this is certainly going to be challenged, the next step is to make sure that everybody, including the police, knows that they have the right to say, no, I will not let you unlock my phone. And that includes a cop taking your phone and then simply holding up to your face and hoping that something good happens, that we have to make sure that everybody understands that this is one of your rights. You don't have to give up a fingerprint or a face scan. But all the same, if I'm ever in a sketchy situation, I might just power down my phone just
in case. Probably be prudent to use an alphanumeric passcode.
And also doesn't affect border crossings, which I think is a much bigger problem.
Right. There is a broader ability to search as you cross into and out of a country. Judge, of course, she's a magistrate judge, so she could be overruled by district court. It could be appealed farther. I don't know if it will be. She said, and I think this is really great, technology is outpacing the law, and that fingerprints and face scan are not the same as physical evidence. That's what they've been considered up to now, right? Like a fingerprint or a hair, when considered in a context where those body features would be used to unlock a phone. It's essentially a recognition the phone is something special, something different.
Yeah.
She said, if a person cannot be compelled to provide a passcode because it is testimonial communication, a person cannot be compelled to provide one's finger, thumb, iris, face, or other biometric feature to unlock that same device. That seems sensible.
It will be challenged, though.
Maybe not in this case, but at some point. And of course,
at some point it will.
It's not law. It's a precedent, but I don't know how strong it is. I'm not a lawyer.
It's critically important, though, because our phones are now basically indistinguishable from external storage. It's like a hard disk with a wire that we're hanging off of our heads instead of hanging off of a computer. And it's keeping track of all the things that we're no longer equipped as humans to keep track of. But eventually that link is going to break down between what's in our head and what's in our phone or what's in our devices. And these are right now maybe external cybernetics, but eventually they'll get more and more internalized and technology will progress to the point where they can start having a real good idea what's knocking around inside our brains. And if we're not really careful about privacy, you know, it sounds like one of those dystopian future movies, but it always happens one step at a time. We'll absolutely lose it. So I think it's best for all of us if we start litigating this stuff as early in that process as possible.
Yeah, the law is hysterically funny in how a precedent can shape unpredictable results in the future. That the whole basis of wiretapping without consent of those or being informed is based on telegraph operators saying that, well, the thing is, we often have to listen in on a telegraph signal to make sure the wires are running properly. And on that basis, the person who is sending a telegraph wire cannot assume that this communication is not being observed by someone else. And therefore, if we were to put a tap on a telegraph line before it even gets to a station or to someone who will turn into a printed message, it's okay for us to do that because the person had no idea that they were sending something that was private. To say nothing of the transcription person, but that was the basis of saying that when we got telephones and then automated switching later on, even though we now have a system where no human is required to ever oversee that signal to make that connection happen, it's still a basic principle that if I'm calling someone on a 4G network that is a secured-ish signal, I have every expectation that this call is being listened into by a third party. So that's why we have to really keep a very close eye on every one of these actions.
This just in, Theresa May's Brexit vote has failed 432 to 202 in the UK Parliament.
Wow.
That'll be interesting. Let's take a break, and we're going to come back. Jim Dalrymple is here from The Loop, loopinsight.com, Andy Anacco, WGBH Boston, and of course, Renee Ritchie, imore.com. All three of you are writers. I pride myself, I think, on my excellent education, my ability to write clearly. However, I wouldn't write anymore these days without Grammarly looking over my shoulder. I'm a blogger.
You're a longtime blogger.
I am a longtime blogger. 12
You're
years.
A thought influencer and brand leader.
It's not a teacher going, no, no, no. It is a very useful writing assistant that makes you look and sound smarter and avoid, everybody makes mistakes, avoid mistakes that make you look dumber. Great time to get Grammarly right now, whether you're in school, a blogger, whether you're writing essays for law, whether you're writing job resumes. Grammarly is awesome. It helps you show your best self through your writing. It's on every platform. They have online browser extensions. There's desktop editors. On iOS, you get a mobile keyboard checker. Chrome, Firefox, Safari, Edge, iOS, Android, Windows, Mac. Their free product does critical spelling and grammar, but I would recommend Grammarly Premium. Partly because of that great email I get every week that says, you use more words than 99% of other Grammarly users. I like that. It looks out for spelling, grammar, plus advanced punctuation, structure, style within context. It understands context. That's really important because your writing's different in a business proposal than it would be in a blog post, right? Conciseness, vocabulary suggestions. They even grade your readability, and that's really important too. You got to know your audience and then make it something that your audience can understand. Accomplish all your goals with help from Grammarly. No more email typos on your phone. Close more deals at work with your emails. Polish your resumes and get that new job. There's nowhere Grammarly isn't a great help. It even didn't do this to me. Did it to Lisa. She wrote an email. She's in a hurry. She writes sometimes her emails are very short and sweet and to the point. And Grammarly said, you might want to soften this up just a little bit. Sounds a little brusque. And she appreciated that. I think that's really great. Go to Grammarly.com/MacBreak and get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. Grammarly. Just remember, MMA, right? There's two A's in grammar. I know that because I used to spell it with an E. Grammarly.com/MacBreak. 20% off your Grammarly premium account right now. Just try it. I think you'll really appreciate it. Grammarly.com/MacBreak. Let's see. Interesting note in Jean-Louis Gasset's Monday note. During Fireballs, John Gruber pulls it up. Gasset wrote that he had a hard time believing that the $29 battery replacement plan could have much of an impact on Apple's numbers. But
he obviously never went to an Apple retail store where they had those lineups for battery replacement.
Apparently,
those places were clogged like, all year.
Mark Gurman at Bloomberg had private notes from an all-hands meeting on January 3rd. You know, those are, you know, not public. But at that meeting, apparently, Tim Cook said Apple replaced 11 million batteries under the $29 replacement program. Which
I think
was,
Gurman had that they had a meeting and Gruber had the number that they discussed.
Gruber has the number. Oh. Yeah. Oh, good on you, John.
Little birdies. Mm-hmm. Little birdies.
Little birdies. So that's about 10 million more, 9 or 10 million more than they would have normally done.
Yeah.
And so really what the question is just did fewer people upgrade to the newer iPhones because their old iPhone worked great. And purely anecdotally, I mentioned this before, my mom, I kept saying, come on, Mom, I'll give you a 10R. I've got one here. I'll give you a 10S Max, whatever you want. And she said, no, my beloved iPhone 6 is better than ever. I got the battery replacement.
I mean, if you go back to the 2018 Q1 conference call, Tony Sakanagi asked Tim Cook if he was at all worried that the battery replacement would affect upgrades. And Tim said, it never entered our minds. That's the last thing we think about. We want to do what's best for our customer. And I have no idea. Ask me next year. So now, obviously,
well, yes,
next
it
year
did.
Has come. So.
And Gasset points out that regardless, they should have known about this. They must have known about this for months, not just the battery, but the drop in sales
people,
in China.
They didn't have new iPhones for months. Like very few people, like when you look at the iPhone release, it's like a blockbuster movie. It's not that, you know, the same amount of people buy it in January who buy it in February who buy it in March. There's a huge spike in September or whatever the release month is, in October, November for some of the more recent phones. But it's a giant spike and you don't see that really affecting it. But if people who got those battery replacements, 11 million people, if even a portion of those by the time it got to September said, you know what, exactly like your mom, this iPhone 6 is working great, maybe I'll wait till next year to get a new iPhone, then that spike is no longer quite so spiky.
But the Chinese economy has been slowing down for a while. It would have been foolish for them to assume they're going to have the same results in China. This was, as Gasset points out and many others have, an S generation phone, and that's typically slower anyway.
Is that still a thing, do you think?
Oh, it's a thing. Of course it's a thing.
It's a moderate thing because some people wait for the S because they think it's going to be a better version of the phone.
Because like this year I thought was a nice deviation from that where it didn't feel like, hey, we took our top of the line flagship phone and made only an incremental adjustment to the processor and the storage. It felt like Apple was saying the folks who really, really wanted an iPhone 10 last year but couldn't really stomach the price, we found a way to give you most of the features in slightly less build quality for a more affordable price. And to my mind, and at least to the people, what seems like the people I was talking to about this, that they almost saw it as a whole new product as opposed to like an S sort of
thing. You're talking about the 10R.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I think the 10S is not significantly different than the 10.
But...
And maybe we watch pretty closely to the average consumer.
It's just the new phone.
It looks the same to me. I don't know if there was a lot of pressure if you had a 10 to go to the 10S. I gave my son my 10. He was very happy to have a 10.
It's hard to think though what they would. I mean, the 10 was so different. Like immediately expecting a phone as different the next year too.
No, you shouldn't. I'm not saying you should expect that. I'm just saying that that's typical of an S year, and that Apple should have known that the 10S wasn't going to be gangbusters compared to the 10 any more than the 6S was gangbusters to the 6.
They were pretty clear that it was like they saw they expected this because they guided down heavily for this quarter. This quarter was already discounted more than I think a lot of people
expected.
So
what surprised them? What was the big surprise?
The amount of battery replacements affecting the upgrade cycle, but that was small. He said mostly, I think he said over 100%, which is a funny number until you actually dig into it, but over 100% was a rapid downturn in the Chinese market, far faster and more extreme than they expected.
And I think if you look at the notes that that Tim provided in his statement, the issue here is the Chinese economy. It's not an iPhone problem. And when Apple first, when Tim first released those notes, people jumped on the iPhone problem. But if you look through all of the things that Apple was able to accomplish in the quarter, it becomes clear very quickly that if it wasn't for China and the economy deceleration, there would have been no need for Apple to do a guidance change. Now, their quarter still wouldn't have been as good as what they would have hoped, but there would be no need for this guidance change. So to say that that the iPhone is failing, or you know, Apple has a huge iPhone problem, I think is a bit overdramatic at this stage. Yes, the upgrade cycles were affected by the battery replacements, and I'm not quite sure why Apple was so surprised with that, or at least as surprised as they seem to be. But you know, that could also be with a lot of users. It could be a comfort level. I've talked to a lot of people that are very weary of Face ID and not having a home button and, you know, just different things. And if they have the chance to keep their phones by replacing a battery, then they're going to do that. And, you know, the economy, I think, of a lot of countries right now are, you know, kind of up in the air, you know, the U.S.-Chinese battle and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's affecting a lot of people in the economy in a lot of different ways. So if somebody has a chance for $29 to keep their current phone, I think they're going to do that. Now, an economic problem in a country as big as China is going to take, it takes a while to go down. I mean, Apple rode that wave up, and right now they're riding that wave down. And right. they have no choice in the matter. It's an economic condition, but that will change again. And the economy will start to rise, and Apple will do that. And let's face it, if this economic problem came from Canada, Apple still wouldn't have had to warn, you know, because the Chinese thing would have been good.
Jim,
if the economic problem was in Switzerland,
Liechtenstein,
or, you know, when they would not have to warn like they did now. This is
also
an economic problem. Yeah. It's not an iPhone problem.
It's also interesting to see now that we've heard from Samsung and we've heard from LG and we've heard from some of the Chinese manufacturers, and their results are in some cases not going to be any better. And I think in LG's case, way, way worse.
Right. Yeah. Everything. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
To be fair to the people that are saying that this is an iPhone problem, are there things that Apple should and could do to affect upgrades in the coming quarters? Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not saying that there isn't. I'm just saying that the all the reporting saying that, you know, the iPhone is dead, I think they're wrong.
Oh yeah, that's a great headline. That's a great way to get people to click until they realize how many times they're clicking on that story today. You make an excellent point. The $29 battery upgrade was a great deal, but even paying full price right now, $49 is not prohibitively expensive to perform an optional upgrade, or excuse me, an optional and available swap that can almost give new life to an old device. And maybe maybe one of the genies out of the bottle is people being aware that, wait a minute, all this time I could have just replaced a battery and been really happy with what I got. And I do think there are people who are worrying of that. They're starting to think of phones the same way they're thinking of their cars, where unless they're on a lease program, they're not used. Now it's like, no, this is the thing that I will keep using until it gets really, really weather beaten and broken and I can't use it anymore. In which case, that's when I shift it off to the kids, and that's when I finally get a new phone. Even this idea of getting a new phone every 2 years because a contract expired, I think is kind of dying. I do wonder if Tim is going to try to spin this at the next keynote by saying, last quarter, we sold over a third of $1 billion in batteries. Applause, 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 applause. And please don't pay attention to this other graph.
One of the things that's really interesting to me, though, is that, and Apple doesn't say this, but this is also partly a problem of their own making. Apple really wants to create premium phones. They don't want to operate on the low end. But in order to justify, or at least partially justify, the price of those phones, they want to make sure they have an incredibly long useful life. And they've had Lisa Jackson involved in that as well. So they have processor overhead, which is set to 5 years. So if you buy it now, that processor should still run 5 years worth of iOS well. The construction, it's built well. It should last well. They've done iOS 12 now, and they're apparently going to keep doing that so that the iOS continues to make these devices run well, because they understand if people spend that much money, they want to keep it for 5 years. And even if they don't, they want to hand it down, or they want to resell it and get a really high resale value, or they want to give it back to Apple where Apple can sell it in emerging markets. And they want to like basically increase the overall value you get for your money. But that does mean that these phones stay on the market for far longer than phones probably did a few years ago. Compare
this to Google, where I'm still using a first generation Pixel phone. It's still running so well, particularly with all the software upgrades that are almost like hardware upgrades, that I didn't buy the Pixel 3 that I thought I was going to be buying this year. Google basically has that crystal in the palm of every single phone, saying that after 3 years it goes to carousel. We'll only promise OS upgrades to our own Pixel products for 3 years time. After that, you're kind of wishful thinking and being hopeful about things. Whereas with Apple, I've had phones that have run for four or five years, and I only voluntarily bought a new one because at this point there's so much new hardware and so much of a new evolution in the CPU and what it can do that I'm actually now attracted to spend $700 or $800 for a new phone. So that's Apple will almost until they take their eyes off the prize, they will always have that built-in advantage as a hardware maker.
And let's remember that there are a lot of reasons to upgrade your phone too, not only because new technology comes out, but because children get to a point where they want a phone. So, it's true. I mean, people do upgrade.
Just so imagine your son grabbing your phone, Jim.
A new phone for the kids, you buy a new phone for yourself and hand yours down. I mean, there are all kinds of different reasons for upgrading. You know, a broken screen.
Used to be, though, Jim, that it was you upgraded because there was an amazing new feature. And that's less the case these days.
But see, the problem these days is that the amazing new features and everything else is coming with amazing new prices, too.
And we haven't mentioned that, but that's a big part.
Or their software, and you get them on your old phone. I mean, that's the beauty of the Google Pixel approach as well. I mean, like I have the Pixel 2, because my Pixel 3 never arrived. I'm salty about it. But, you know, it's getting so much stuff that I'm not really that complaining about it right now.
I hear a lot of people saying that.
There's also the question of, is there going to be a time where Apple will want to be more proactive about third-party updates? Some of the coolest YouTube videos I've seen that are iPhone related are people who like live in Shenzhen. And so if they want to buy, so they can really buy every tool they need to do any sort of repair or upgrade they want. And including, I've got an iPhone 6, I've just added wireless charging to it. Or I've got an iPhone 8, I've just added a headphone jack to it. And those are fun and ridiculous. But we're even talking about things like, I'm going to remove the memory chip, reball a higher capacity one, and basically turn a 16 gigabyte phone into a 128 gigabyte phone. And it's not something that requires clean room sort of stuff. Essentially, this guy had to make 1 week's worth of like occasional trips to the market on foot to buy. I can't get this board reballed correctly. So I go to a stall in a shop and buy a template that has the exact right pinouts for the exact model of phone. This is something that somebody in a strip mall could easily do, particularly after they've killed their first 20 and they're on their 50th or 60th. Is there going to be a time where my screen is fine? I think the CPU performance is fine. It runs all the software I want. I just wish I didn't get the 32 gig model. I want 128 gigs. If I had the ability to spend $100 to get my phone refreshed with a memory upgrade and a battery upgrade by a cowboy or cowgirl who ordered the right stuff from Alibaba, that's interesting, isn't it?
It's driven by the lack of change in the platform, though. I mean, this PC industry has kind of been through this as well, where Intel's processors really weren't getting that much faster, and there just wasn't that much demand for new PCs. It really tumbled.
Why they want Johnny Cerruti so badly, Leo?
Yeah, but I mean, some of this is overcome by marketing. Some of it is eventually will be overcome, I'm sure, by innovation. And that's why Apple's looking so hard at augmented reality.
But it's kind of like, I call it the saturationing. It's like we are the part of the PC era where everybody who wants a phone has a phone that they're pretty much happy with.
And it's okay. Yeah. I think that that notion that you have to have the latest phone I'm hoping is gone. I mean, that was a bad trend.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be like any industry where, like, there are people who buy the new Canon body whenever that new Canon body comes up because they love it. So, but that's what it becomes. Like, your constant adopters become a niche, and then your mainstream adopters pull out dramatically increase the adoption cycle. And so what you do is you sell them AirPods and you sell them Apple Music and Apple Television subscriptions, and you do all sorts of other things.
Apple probably has a larger share, though, of those enthusiasts than any other manufacturer, I would think.
And also, well, could Apple preempt this and create a new hardware channel by simply saying that after a certain amount of years go by, after a phone is out of Apple care by one way or another, we will allow you to buy a 128 gig upgrade or 256 upgrade or a motherboard upgrade. If at some point, if they see that the writing is kind of on the wall here, that we see where our profit, our hardware sales are flattening out. If we can no longer make 40% markup on an $800 phone, maybe we can make 40% markup on a $200 board upgrade.
You know what's going to save Apple? The Air Power Charger.
Dum, dum, dum.
Finally coming, according to a Hong Kong website, Charger Lab. Again, this is from the supply chain. A company called LuxShare Precision, which is a part of the Wireless Power Consortium, assembles AirPods for Apple and Lightning to USB-C cables. According to Charger Lab, LuxShare is now making the Apple Air Power Wireless Charging Pad. So,
my standard is that if it was on Weibo, it's got to be true.
Yeah, it's one of those rumors.
Daddy just went out to get cigarettes, and he's going to be back any day now. He's just out there.
Really, you guys don't think we're going to see it? Come on.
I will not believe it until I actually see it on the Apple website.
A couple of weeks ago, Trouton Smith said he's heard that Apple may have solved the technical challenges.
That's the story. But the thing is, like Andy said, this is like a Gandalf thing for me. Expect it when you see it, because we've had like the Swiss retail channel say that it was coming last December or January. And it's just until this thing is actually in stores, anything could happen. We could find out that the white is discoloring, or we could find out that it doesn't do. This is a shut up and ship thing for me at this point.
You're skeptical. and anyway, we'd have to get new.
I'm not skeptical. It's just I'm tired. Leo.
We'd have to get new cases for our AirPods with wireless charging built in. So that's going to happen first.
The difference between being skeptical and simply saying at this point, I'm not even going to comment on it. My only comment is we do not comment on unreleased AirPod, unreleased AirPods.
Actually, I was surprised to see this. Tim Cook said the revenue for Apple's wearables, watches, and AirPods is 50% higher than the iPod at its peak. Not just the iPod, when it first started out. The iPod, he's talking to Mad Money's Jim Cramer. The iPod at its peak. That's stunning. The watch and the AirPods have each generated between 4 to 6 times more sales than the iPod had generated in the same amount of time since its launch.
I believe Apple Watch by itself is also, it's not 1.5, but it's also higher than iPod, which is, it's so funny. A while ago, Neil Seibert put this thing up saying, everybody thinks the Apple Watch is a failure and the Echo is a huge success when Apple Watch is selling, I think it was 10 or 20X. Because there's so much, we're all dealing with imaginary numbers. Like Apple doesn't disclose Apple Watch numbers, Amazon doesn't disclose Echo numbers. So it's like all fantasy math. But when you start looking at how much of these things are going out the door and how much of the percentage of the other category, or now the new wearables category, people like Neil can start to piece these numbers together, and Tim just gave them away. It's a huge market. But when you look at how big iPod was, and then you look at how big Apple Watch and an AirPods have become, and those are all dependent on iPhone, you start to understand why all this decade of building up iPhone as a platform has kind of set the stage for using iPhone as a platform to build up the next decade of products, the way iTunes and iPod built up iPhone. And that's one of my favorite aspects of Apple, is that they're one of these companies that never mistakes their product for their business. Like, Apple never became an iPod company the way that Microsoft for a long time was a Windows company, you know, and they'll ride this into the last dime. Apple's like, okay, this is going down. We're going to get the iPhone up. Okay, iPhone is going down. We got to make sure we have the AirPods, the Apple Watch, everything else prepped. And you start to see these in the results. And when you take away the iPhone distortion from this quarter, I think Cook said they're going to be up 19% on almost everything else.
Yeah,
which is super interesting. It's going to be the second biggest quarter in their history. I mean, they're still going to get killed for it. It'll be the second biggest quarter in their history.
Yeah. Can we also point out that's how badly the iPhone letter affected everything, that Tim Cook is eagerly sharing numbers on the success of something that they didn't share numbers on
with
before.
Jim Cramer.
Yeah, exactly. Of all people.
You know, we were talking about privacy. DuckDuckGo just announced that they're going to use Apple Maps for their maps for local searches on the web. DuckDuckGo, of course, the privacy alternative to Google search.
That's absolutely consistent. They could have gone for a real open source mapping solution. There are a couple out there.
OpenStreetMap is a good one, but it's not as good, frankly.
It's not as good, but sometimes partnerships like this are what makes what has to happen to make things even better. Yeah. So that's a really, really smart move. Again, that's kind of what I was talking about earlier, that if DuckDuckGo is saying that this is what we are, privacy oriented, well, if that's the product you're selling, you really can't send people to a service like Google Maps that has an incredible amount of advantages. But one of the disadvantages is that Google is going to be collecting information to both enhance the map and also to enhance their advertising product.
I guess DuckDuckGo was using OpenStreetMap, but if you asked for directions, you got Bing.
It's just like open source is great, but you've got to spend so much money to go out. Like, you literally have to have the trucks on every street the way Google did and the way Apple does now, and that's non-trivial for any company.
Yeah, OpenStreetMap relies on users to modify and update their maps.
You have to finding entrances is an amazing amount of technology for places. You can't, and the amount of work that Google does just to figure out that, yes, here is a street address, but you're going to walk a half a mile if a car drops you off on this side of the block as opposed to this other side of the block. And I still remember riding around with a member of the Wear Map team for Nokia, saying that we have to send someone out. We have to physically send somebody out, not an automated car. We have to send somebody out to everything that we think is a hospital to make sure that A, it is actually a hospital, and also to
that's pretty important.
Also to locate where the emergency room entrance is specifically. So that is another underscoring how difficult Maps is.
And that's what Apple is spending billions on for the new version of Apple Maps and driving all those streets and doing all that mapping. And that's just hard to get any. You can crowdsource that, but you won't get the consistent pull through of data that you get when you actually drive it.
Let's take a little time out, and then we're going to talk about Apple's next thing, which Tim Cook says might be health. The episode you're watching of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. We need LastPass here at work. We use it at LastPass Enterprise. At home, I use it. Steve Gibson uses it. That's a pretty strong recommendation from my point of view. It is a password manager with trust no one encryption. Your data is encrypted and decrypted only at the device level. Not even LastPass can access anything in your vault. Zero knowledge. It's also the most convenient, the easiest to use. It's just a great password vault. And in your business, you know that your employees are not using the best practices when it comes to passwords. Just go down into the business office, see how many post-it notes are on the monitor with the password to your checking account on it. Or in the engineering office, there's probably a notebook somewhere with all the passwords to your website and all your databases and so forth. You need strong passwords. You need passwords that aren't reused. You need passwords that are stored securely and shared securely. You need LastPass Enterprise. It makes password sharing convenient for employees. It's got to be, or they won't use it, but it keeps access to your corporate data secure. And you have complete admin oversight. You could set master password requirements, enable password resets, restrict access if an employee leaves. You can configure over 100 policies, access actionable security reports, create shared folders. We do that The ops team has their folder. The business team has their folder. That makes it very easy to get the password you need without actually seeing the password. That's another nice feature. So it turns out employees share passwords, not just with other employees, but with their friends and family. Keep those passwords secured. They don't need to know them. They just need to log in. I trust LastPass so much, we keep everything in there. Database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, business information. At home, I keep my passport, my driver's license, even my social security numbers are in LastPass. I know they're safe there, and they're easy to get to. When I travel, I've got my passport available, securely stored in LastPass. I think that's fantastic. And when it comes time to create a new password, LastPass's password generator makes it really easy to create unique, truly random passwords. They're not memorable, but don't worry. LastPass keeps track. You don't have to write it down. And the password autofill functionality now in iOS 12, it's available on Android as well, in Oreo and later, makes it so easy for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across their mobile devices. In fact, it's so easy, it's the first app I install when I get a new phone because it's going to let me log into all the other apps faster and easier. I don't have to copy and paste. It just fills them in. I just love it. If you want to turn on multi-factor authentication, and we do require that, by the way, at TWIT, you have a variety of multi-factor tools, Duo, YubiKey, and, of course, LastPass's own authenticator app, which will send a push notification, not a text message, but a push notification. That's more secure. To your phone saying approve, deny that login. The second factor is so important because, of course, even if your passwords are breached, second factor keeps bad guys from getting in. You don't want to be the next company on the big breach list. You need LastPass. Here's another nice benefit. If you're an Active Directory user, your company, they can use their Microsoft AD credentials for a true single sign-on experience. LastPass, LastPass Teams, for teams of 50 or fewer, LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your family, that's what we use at home, and of course LastPass Enterprise, that's what we use here at work. Join the 43,000 businesses and the millions of users who trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. I wouldn't leave home without it. Find the best password solution for your team at lastpass.com/twit, lastpass.com/twit. It is on everything you see here. My phones, my laptops, my desktops, everywhere. Love the LastPass. So, Tim Cook says Apple's greatest contribution to mankind will be coming in 2019, and it will be health-related. This is part of the Jim Cramer interview.
I think those are two separate things.
Oh, they're separate?
I think he said that in number one, we got new services coming up in 2019, and then our greatest thing for mankind is going to be health.
Oh, okay.
And I believe both things.
So I shouldn't say there will be new health services in 2019. In fact, it's probably a new video service, maybe a new news service.
New publishing stuff with the magazine company they bought, and new video next service. Year.
Yeah. And you think next year we'll be seeing healthcare, Renee?
Texture.
I think. It'll be constant. Like they are really all in on health. And it was sort of serendipitous for them because, again, like they'll tell you the story that they only wanted an accurate calorie count for Apple Watch. And because of that, they made a heart rate monitor. And then they saw all the data they were getting off the heart rate monitor. And then Jeff Williams, who was running Watch at the time, got very interested in health. And they started doing research kit and care kit. And I think that's the sort of thing that they're going to incrementally grow as they see new opportunities. Like they've done healthcare records now. And they also have the Apple technology where you can use your watch as a badge. And it starts to get really interesting. It's easy to imagine one day you'll walk into a clinic, you'll tap your Apple Watch, and that will grant permission for that clinic to access your healthcare records. And it'll be a private transaction that you have complete authority over. And they'll know your entire history, what medication you're on, what health issues you have, your previous thing.
Really becomes a big deal.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I think Apple really believes that they can leverage is that they originally were absolutists about trust, about privacy, but then they saw that with the healthcare industry, they had people who, for example, because of their conditions, couldn't keep track of their medication or couldn't accurately report back what they were doing with the research studies. So if they created the ability for them to grant explicit permission for some of that information to be shared, and they found out that when it was done, like that old Steve Jobs things, ask him again, tell him in simple language, in plain language, and do it until they ask you to stop asking them. But once they implemented that, you're getting all these amazing studies onto things like multiple sclerosis, which we previously had multiple medications and they would have to guess which one to give you, and postpartum depression and all these other studies. And it's proving that Apple, if you are in a trusted position like Apple, you can start to do some pretty amazing things in the healthcare industry.
Yeah, and these people, these studies that Apple is doing, those people have said that they've never had so many people sign up for the studies and want to be part of the studies, which helps the medical community. You know, they get more information than what they've ever had before. They get a wider variety of people signing up for these. So I agree. I think that healthcare is going to be one of the biggest things that Apple ever does.
Tim Cook said in this interview, on healthcare in particular and your well-being, this is an area that I believe if you zoom into the future and you look back and you ask the question, what was Apple's greatest contribution to mankind? It will be about health.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It is. I think that's the closest thing to Apple's historical mission to try to improve people's lives through technology. And you can't do a better improvement on someone's lives than preventing them from having an injury that changes the entire direction of their remaining days, or reducing it to zero. I mean, even the basis, the number of stories that we're getting back of people being able to point to data on their Apple Watch as a way of describing, hey, I was climbing stairs and I suddenly just absolutely felt exhausted, and that was not normal for me. That was 3 days ago, and here's my heart rate, and here's a strip that I took like when I was feeling that way. And if you do all the tests today, you're perfectly normal, but you can actually show, here's the data that was collected, the time where I was feeling incredibly not right. And now you might not necessarily have had your life saved by that piece of data, but now you have more information on trying to figure out exactly why did you have to sit down after climbing a flight of stairs for the first time in 2 or 3 or 4 years. I have to say that I'm wondering why Apple has not made the Apple Watch into a broader sort of product, like they did with the iPhone, like they did with the iPod, and make it multi-platform, because not only is it a huge amount of money that they can make off of all of these things, but also the more data that comes in, the bigger benefit, and the more people who have access to buying these things, the more improvements of lives they can do. And finally, wearables on almost every other platform is either non-ambitious, meaning it's just sort of a fitness tracker that works well, but it's just a fitness tracker, or it's a total mess like Android Wear, where it could be the Apple Watch, but they don't have the hardware, they don't have the engineering, they don't have the unified sort of idea of here's what we're going to be doing with the data that we're going to be tracking. I still often wear my Series 0 watch, even though I'm an Android user, because it's just my favorite fitness watch ever. I'm considering buying a new one.
I think they're just it took until iOS 5 before iPhone was independent from iTunes and went to the iCloud. I think they're just waiting for the device to have the capabilities where it doesn't matter what platform you have. Instead of logging in with an Apple ID, you log in with a Google ID and you're fine regardless of what phone you have. It's just all your stuff.
They could still do an Apple ID on other platforms, but I'd be surprised if they don't have a target for it. I will also say I'm surprised that you have to have an iPhone. You can't set it up using an iPad or a Mac, because if that were the case, I would have upgraded my Series 0 like 2 or 3 years ago.
But why wouldn't you just want to get an iPhone, Andy? Come on, get with the program.
Yeah, see, it's not enough. I have to have like a card in the mail saying, here's how many years of your life you will get back if you switch from the phone you like to a phone that is fine, but it's not for you.
It's not just
Rennie can send you one of those cards.
You can make one.
Okay, but are there going to be good years, or are there going to be like the crap years from like 87 to 90 where I have no living relatives left, I'm in a nursing home, and
where's my sugar Coke? Just give me my damn sugar Coke.
We're focused on the watch, but AirPods could also end up being a big thing. But this is in August of next year. The FDA's funding bill in 2017 included an interesting statement that the FDA would have to investigate by August 2020, would have to introduce rules on over-the-counter hearing aids.
Yeah. That's
and a big already deal. We saw Eargo at CES with a in-ear, much less expensive hearing aid that also did some you know, health tracking.
Yeah,
Starkey, which makes the hearing aids I used to use. I'm now a ReSound user, but the now has a Livio platform that does that as well. And Apple's perfectly situated to jump on that, the over-the-counter hearing aid market, and the wearables, or hearables, I guess you should call them.
They'll be the new iPods, Leo. I mean, they'll have health functionality akin to an Apple Watch and also be able to stream Apple Music. That's not a long-term goal, I don't think.
Yeah. I think that's a very big opportunity. So it's the watch is just the entry. The other question I have is can you ascribe this really to Tim Cook? Now, I think Steve became very interested in health as he was dying. And I think Tim, as he's sitting there watching him pass away, also, and I think that he's even said this, became very aware of this. But this is really, give Tim Cook credit, I think, for that one, for saying, maybe for privacy, Steve was big on that, but absolutely for health.
And Jeff Williams, too. I mean, he'll just sit there and I mean, they deeply believe in privacy and health and all of these things. It's not trendy for them. It's just part of the expression of what they believe their company should be used for.
Yeah.
Well, and you can tell that Jeff has really taken up the baton here for health. And when you hear him speak, this is something that he really believes in.
So let's talk about Qualcomm. the gift that just keeps on giving. And the last time we talked, Apple had to stop selling its iPhone 7 and 8 in Germany. Well, a German court has now thrown out Qualcomm's patent case against Apple. Just earlier today, this is a big reversal for Qualcomm, the regional court in the city of Mannheim. That's the big town where they make steamrollers, right? Dismissed the Qualcomm suit as groundless.
Dad. Mom, dad, make those jokes again.
saying the patent in question was not violated by the installation of its chips in Apple's smartphones. Apple said, we're happy with the decision. Qualcomm, well, you know, Qualcomm's not happy. Apple has a history of infringing our patents. While we disagree,
the conflation between licensing and chipsets within Qualcomm is kind of
weird.
Well,
and I didn't know this, but I learned this here, but Qualcomm refused to sell Apple its chips for the latest generations of phones. I thought Apple was trying to get over, you know, move to Intel to get out of this, but in fact it was they wanted to buy the Qualcomm chips and they couldn't.
Well, that's part of the problem here. It's sort of like with the old Intel lawsuits or the old Microsoft laws where in order to have one you have to have the other and then they will penalize you if you don't go all in with them. And that's all of the information that's coming out. And I think that's why so many independent jurisdictions are also going after Qualcomm, never mind the Apple lawsuit, like Federal Trade Commission and other commissions in other countries, is because they were doing that sort of bundle. They were doing the things you do when you abuse a position, like bundling and like they could choose. They could choose not to be part of standards. They could say, we're doing our own proprietary thing. We think it's amazing. If you want to use it, we'll make sure that it works where it works. But they're like, no, we want everybody to use it. But now we want to charge you exorbitantly for it. And especially in the EU and maybe in the US now, I don't think that's going to be tenable.
It's hard. I've been trying to understand everything about this lawsuit, and this result of like this used to be a little bit browner here in my sideburns, and that's this little patch of gray, and I really don't know how I feel about it. The Qualcomm, for their part, they make a pretty good argument, at least for the FTC case, which is saying so what have we done to abuse consumers? Phones have never been cheaper. The consumers are not paying a price for whatever you think is going on. There is an alternative to Qualcomm. We are and as a counter to the so I'm wondering how, at least in the United States, the FTC action is going to play out, because there are great cases to be made on both sides of Qualcomm simply trying to make money off of something that they've been doing extremely well and navigating a business also extremely well, versus the other stuff that they've been doing, which is like it doesn't seem as though they're doing the right thing by double dipping, as Renee says. So I'm almost at the state where I'm just going to wait to see who's still alive in two years.
That's what makes it so interesting, is that, like, absolutely, like, Qualcomm is, you get every dollar you can, but there is a point where your short-term gain comes at the expense of your long-term viability. Yeah. And again, I use the Microsoft example, where they rode Windows so hard that it caused them to ignore other potentials that could have, you know, like, lots of stuff I wanted to see on the market. And Qualcomm, first, they have that licensing, that patent arm, which is so important to them, but that comes a little bit at the expense of their chipset business. And they want people to pay based on the price of the device, because they believe their component is so important that it's worth more than just the component itself. But you can't scale that. Like, if suddenly the phones are cameras now, the people buy phones because of the cameras, we make the sensor, we deserve part of the entire phone price. Oh, but you know, the chipset, you know, we're making these we're fabbing these processors for you, people buy because of the chipset, so now we want a part of the, there's only so many parts of that phone that you can divvy up. And I think Qualcomm would have an amazingly robust business and would have an amazing growth curve if they're like, okay, you pay us for the chip and license these products, and you know, everyone shakes hands and goes home afterwards.
It's, you know, yeah, it's hard to say. You could also I'm explicitly playing devil's advocate here, as opposed to asserting a point of view that I hold dear to myself. There is, you could make a devil's advocate could make a comparison to Apple's defense of their iPhone business, that yes, they have so many other businesses, but really, if the iPhone were to go away magically tomorrow, they would be screwed with a double K in the word screwed. Nonetheless, Qualcomm is in a lot of other businesses. They make CPUs, they make Wi-Fi chips, make Bluetooth chips, mobile processors, game processors, but the lion's share of their money comes from cellular modems, because again, this is what they built their business around. It's hard. I don't understand the business enough to have a really good opinion on who's absolutely right and who's absolutely wrong here. I hope it doesn't come to a point where users' experience will suffer, because the thing is, we really like Qualcomm chips in our modems. They really work extremely well, especially if you travel, especially if you're in parts of the world where there aren't really, really great unified cellular networks, and you have to keep buying coverage as you go. So, again, I'm continuing to read about this. I don't know what it would feel.
It just feels like the one company you don't want to encourage to make their own chips is Apple, just given their history of making their own chips.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That's something you don't want to do. And you know, to Andy's point, you know, who's expressly right and who's expressly wrong? I think in situations like this, there isn't one company that's completely right and one that's completely wrong. But, you know, I know that Rene said jokingly and not jokingly, you don't want to encourage Apple to start making its own chips.
Good news. We've created a whole new network that's so better than any standard we could have possibly.
No, but I mean, just to make it personal.
Have done that and have lost.
So to make it personal for a minute, I had to pay the Qualcomm tax on my iPhone, even though there hasn't been CDMA anywhere in Canada for I think a decade now, just because they demand that regardless of where you are. And I could have paid, I don't know, $20-$30 conceivably less for my phone, because I would have just had a regular GSM modem. Like, you know, like a small country off from the top of your hat.
According to Jeff Williams, it's $7.50 per phone. That's a lot.
I think some of the companies that are suing, organizations that are suing Qualcomm, have said it's as high as 20, but that's another area that I can't really find out where the actual number is.
The chips and the license, I think you have add them both together to get the...
Yeah.
So you have to buy the
Qualcomm
chips.
Dollars. Yeah. And the license that goes with them, because you don't get the license with the chips, as far as I remember. It would be nice if the license came with the chips.
And you're saying that in order to make an iPhone, even if you don't need the CDMA architecture, you need to license that.
Well, because Qualcomm, they were doing these world phones for a while that you could use on Verizon Plus all the way around the world. And because Qualcomm modems are so good, people want them. But there, Qualcomm won't make one that doesn't include CDMA, because that's their bread and butter. I mean,
although
it's licensing all the way down.
Qualcomm does have 5G patents as well.
Yeah, rinse and repeat, Leo.
So they're not. You know, it's not just the outdated stuff. It's
they have LTE patents. They have 5G patents.
Yeah.
The other aspect that confuses me is that in some regions they are In some regions, they're required to cover a minimum number of bands that might include CDMA but might not. And Qualcomm's position might be that we really don't want to create a whole other chipset just to take care of this one part of the world in which CDMA doesn't exist and we don't have to pay for it. We feel as though the amount of sales we're going to lose by charging extra for a license people are a manufacturer is going to lose is less than the amount of money we'd have to spend to have a new fab or to have an alternative flavor of this chip. So again, I have to get very zen and say I do not even know what I do not know.
I'm just so happy that AT&T's 5G is not affected by Qualcomm 5G.
Because it's not 5G.
That sticker works. That's just, you just put a knee on it. Sticker off, you put it
Did
on
Did you see the T-Mobile response where T-Mobile said BRB and they put a post-it note with 9G on top of it?
This is great. I think they're hiring Nigel Tufnell as their spokesperson. Like, well, when you've got 4G, then it's not fast enough. Where'd you go from there? We've got 5G. Well, why don't you just have 4G and just make that a little bit faster and make that the highest speed?
So the iPhone 10S, 10S Max, and 10R only have Intel 4G chips in it.
Yeah.
What Williams said in his testimony on Monday is we were going to, because we wanted 5G, you know, every major Android vendor in the U.S. has a 5G phone. Intel's 5G modem isn't expected to hit phones until 2020. Williams said the strategy was to dual source in 2018 as well. We were working toward doing that with Qualcomm, but in the end, they would not support us or sell us chips. He said
that's what they did last year.
Yeah.
If you were on Verizon, you got the Qualcomm. If you were on everywhere else, you got the Intel.
Yeah, and of course, Apple famously slowed down the Qualcomm so it would be as dumb as the Intel. he said he contacted Qualcomm CEO to get him to sell chips to Apple. When Qualcomm refused, Apple had to call Intel's CEO, ask him to supply all the modems needed for the iPhone instead of only half the volume. He had to scramble, Williams said. We would have loved to have continued access to Qualcomm tech. So it's not that Apple doesn't want Qualcomm. They do.
Nope.
Yeah.
They just don't want to pay them.
Again, it's the gold standard.
They don't want to pay them as much as they're being asked. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have a Qualcomm modem, all your problems are solved. You do not have to worry about anything in terms of compatibility and connectivity and speed.
Well, I don't want to pay Apple $1,000 for an iPhone. So there.
Yeah.
Sell it to me for less. You know, that's what it costs.
So this is, this, yeah, I mean, you can buy a different phone.
Yeah, and also the Apple's defense is sort of like that would be like if they're saying yes, you can buy an iPhone, but we're marking up $120 because we're also selling you a pair of AirPods, and you can't buy it without AirPods. But I don't want AirPods. Well, it's too bad, you're getting it anyway. That's the argument about how Qualcomm is abusing the markets. But they're also
selling it to you. Like, imaginously, it's like not that you don't want to buy an iPhone. It's that you don't want to pay a percentage of your gross revenue for the price of the iPhone.
Okay,
you just
that's
want to
fair.
Pay the same base price that everybody else pays.
Right.
It's maybe the better analogy is Ticketmaster. It's like, why am I being charged an extra $30 for this $80 ticket? Because. Usually you say because.
It's
why?
A well, service fee.
Because. Exactly. It's
a service fee. Apple's going to start selling the HomePod in China soon. That'll be an interesting...
Just should agenda.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
January 18th.
Siri will start disappointing users in a whole other language.
Oh, they've been doing that on iPhone for years.
So every time I say, hey, you know who, in my kitchen, I mean, I'm 15 feet away from my HomePod. I'm sitting, distantly. I'm right next to my phone, but the HomePod takes over every single time. Is that supposed to happen?
Well, sorry, Jim, go ahead.
The way that it works is if your device, whatever device you want, your phone or your watch is active, then that will answer.
But the HomePod's always active.
That hey thing.
It's not playing anything. But it's always active compared to an iPhone.
Just listening to you, Leo.
But all of those devices communicate among themselves. And say, okay, who's going to take this?
Right.
And if nothing is being used, like you don't lift your watch to your mouth, or you don't lift your iPhone and make it active, then the HomePod will be the one to answer the call.
Oh. So what I should do is I should shake my phone before I say, hey, Shlomo.
or hit it with a hammer. That always works.
Blow into it like a Nintendo cartridge. That works for me.
It's be crazy. I do have to thank the NFL because during all the NFL games, they say, hey, Shlomo, give me the scores or something. Drives me nuts because my HomePod always hears it and always launches into a 15-minute tirade. They changed. Is this your experience too, Jim? They changed something this weekend. It stopped activating it.
During the college football games and everything that was going on,
watching
it
playoffs.
Was driving me crazy.
I do know with other systems,
Amazon does that. They fuzz it.
What they actually do is they have their servers have a way of telling that all of a sudden everybody is active as asking for Alyosha to do something at the same time. We're going to guess that this is a commercial or this is a radio thing that's happened. So we're going to basically ignore that. And if it was a legitimate request, the person's just going to ask it again and no harm, no foul.
Okay.
But yeah, but they are doing something. I had my Google Home Max is right above like my bedroom TV. And so I was, as part of research, I was in bed until 11 a.m. watching some like Google corporate videos in which the latest ad, in which it's just, hey, Guillermo, do this. And it was lighting up but not responding. So it's not just that because not everyone was watching that ad at the same time.
So, okay, now wait a minute. You got Guillermo, you got Shlomo, and you got Alyosha.
Yes.
What do you call Cortana?
I don't call it Cortana for dinner. Because we could say it's the one name that's not. We could say Cortana.
Nothing happens
here because
nothing happens.
Yes. Oh, Leo, the new iPhone battery cases just went live.
Oh, is that? I didn't even know there were going to be new iPhones.
XS Max, and XS.
These are the hump cases.
Yep.
The hump cases, huh?
Should we talk amongst ourselves?
I don't know. I don't buy these. Order them. I don't like them. I think they look funky.
But they have good. They have good characteristics.
So be under iPhone accessories. What are the good characteristics?
They a lot of battery cases do is they get in the way of the signal, so the radio has to ramp up and expends more power while you're trying to charge it. These get out of the way and they have antenna amplifiers. They also, a lot of battery cases put the iPhone in plugged-in mode, which spirals up all the networking and all the updating. These keep iPhone in mobile mode, so it's not expending all the extra energy. So again, you're not expending energy as fast as you're charging it.
Well, this must be a Canadian thing because I don't see it on my for the first time ever, Canada gets it first.
I just
clicked on the link. I'll throw the link in the show notes.
Okay.
Yeah, that saves you money. The number of times I've had like an iPhone in a battery sled and it's thought, oh, I'm connected to power. Now I can do all the photo and video uploads that I'm not supposed to do until I'm connected to actual wall power. It's like, no, I'm still on cellular.
I just bought four. Not one, not two, but four Aukey Type-C power banks. They're very thin, and they don't affect anything because you just plug the phone into them.
Yeah.
And I have four of them because, Pokemon Go.
I know.
They're nice, though, because they're power delivery, so it's over Type-C, so they charge very quickly. They're nice.
We've definitely crossed over a certain mountain recently because this was a year that I've started replacing all of like the old power bricks and old power battery chargers that I keep in one in every single computer bag of mine with USB-C ones because now I've got enough USB-C stuff that it makes sense for me to plug directly into a USB-C type charger or a USB-C charger that can charge an entire laptop. Whereas before it was like, as long as I can charge a phone, I'm good.
Yeah. I think we can take a little tiny time out and come back. If you will prepare your picks, we will be doing that next. First, a word from Atlassian. We love Atlassian here. We're in an Atlassian shop. And I think if you talk to developers, IT professionals, and you say, are you an Atlassian shop? They'll certainly know what you're talking about. And most of them will say, we wouldn't be anything else. Atlassian creates collaboration software that empowers teams around the world. It is, a high-stakes business, keeping track of your ops And having the right tools can make your job a lot easier and make you a lot more effective. Of course, everybody knows Atlassian's Jira, which is a great way to plan, track, and support software. It's agile. Bitbucket is a great one for keeping track of your code base, if you've got a code base. We use Confluence for documentation all the time. In fact, last time I did an ad, somebody in the chat room said, I'm in Confluence right now writing docs. Nobody wants to write docs, right? But you need to have documentation for your setup, for how things work. At least if you're going to do it in a way that makes people want to do it. Confluence, not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes in all areas, from DevOps to Agile, from IT apps to ops to IT, SM, and whatever's next. And you can see there's a whole lot more going on in there. Atlassian provides a technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that propels the business. Jira, Confluence, Bitbucket, that's the backbone of an effective cross-team project planning organization and communication. And then you've got Jira Ops and Ops Genie and Status Page. That really helps teams better detect incidents, alert response teams, coordinate response efforts. Your teams can choose the tools that are right for your current framework, but trusting that as you grow, they will grow with you. And it all integrates seamlessly with Jira and Confluence, so your team can get the job done. Look at all the big companies that rely on Atlassian. 125,000 companies worldwide. We're proud to be an Atlassian shop. Find out more. Like all of the tools at Atlassian, they're easy and free to try. Just head to Atlassian.com to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team, and then let it grow with you. Try Atlassian today and unleash your team's potential. We're big fans. Atlassian, Atlassian.com. Pick of the week time. I like it. Jim Dalrymple usually has a great rock and roll pick for us. What do you have today, Jim?
So I have a band, and I believe I mentioned them very early on when I started doing this show with you, but I'm going to mention them again. It's called, A Pale Horse Named Death.
Oh, yeah,
and this is a metal band, but they're a rock band too. And they're coming out with a new album. There are three songs out right now on Apple Music, and the album is coming out on the 18th of January. So I thought it was good timing, since you invited me back, that I would bring a brand new album to the listeners.
Yay.
Now, this band is founded by the drummer of Typo Negative. And very, very good band. If you just like good rock, but some of it is slowed down a little more. So it's not really, it is metal and it's not. I mean, I think a lot of it is just good rock music. So there you go.
You know, it makes me so sad that none of the current pop charts are rock. Rock is really kind of disappearing from the American music scene. And it is the in my opinion, it is the American music scene.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad to see rock is not dead, and that people are keeping it alive.
They are a really, really good band. And, you know, some of their songs tell about like the journey of being a rock star and things like that. Some of them are funny, and, you know, some of them are very truthful about drug addiction and things like that. And, you know, it's not just thrashing around on instruments. There's some sad stories in there, too.
Yeah. In the great tradition of rock and roll.
Yes, sir.
All right. Good pick. A Pale Horse Named Death. Rock out. Andy Anatko, your pick of the week.
I'm if you're into Schadenfreude, this is a great week to be subscribers to Netflix and Hulu, because two competing documentaries about the Fyre Festival and the debacle that ensued.
Fyre. Oh boy.
Fyre. F-Y-R-E. Hulu's documentary Surprise dropped like last night, 4 days before Netflix's documentary is dropping on Friday. I only found out about it at like midnight. And of course, I was up another 2 hours watching it. And it was a terrific documentary. Your lowest hopes would have been that it's just, hey, look, here's some stuff we got off of Instagram of people having a bad time. And hey, look, here's another shot of that cheese sandwich that you saw on Instagram a while ago. It's a very, very thoughtful documentary about the process of social media influencers and how a crap storm like this can happen, not only because of how easy it is to promise a group of people something that can't possibly be delivered by hooking into their dreams and aspirations, but also how there is still this tech bro sort of culture that says that so long as, you know, I'm wearing my sunglasses and a backwards baseball cap, I can raise millions and millions of dollars for an event that everybody is telling me can't possibly work, no matter how many lies that I tell. It's more of a business documentary. I don't want to downplay it that way, but you will learn a lot more than not just the Fyre Festival. You'll kind of learn about how the next Fyre Festival is definitely going to happen. I haven't seen the Netflix one, but this one was produced by a couple of the social media promotional team members that actually promoted the festival, which means that A, they have access to a whole bunch of video and information that maybe the other producers didn't have. And also it's being told by producers who have some skin in the game of trying not to look like idiots. Part of what I really enjoyed about the Hulu documentary is that you really do have different levels. They were talking to social media influencers who I'm still absolutely puzzled by, but you're also talking to reporters who are covering this event and covering the broader stories around it, and also people who are in mainstream advertising who rely on this sort of an outlet, who are giving a very, very sober sort of discussion, even as they are they're in business interview mode. They're in nice little professional suits on a neutral backdrop, being shot in high definition and being forced to talk soberly and seriously about like a media organization called F. Jerry. And like they're talking about Raytheon or Halliburton, which is also the biggest laugh that I think I'll get all week long. But I really enjoyed the Hulu documentary. I think it was called Fyre Fraud. And I really heartily recommend it. And I'm definitely going to be tuning in for the Netflix one.
Nice. Reminds me of the world record egg. Did you see this on Instagram?
Oh, God.
I saw people making videos about it, trying to get in on it.
This is the most liked image in history on Instagram, the world record egg. It's just a picture of an egg. 42,792,968 likes. And the reason it's doing so well is because they're trying to beat the current world record held by Kylie Jenner. Boy, did they beat it.
That's a very 2019 thing. We're liking this thing not because we like the egg, but to show our dislike for an actual human being.
Yeah, that's really what it's all about. Yep. Is how much we hate the Kardashians right there.
That's so empty.
Renee, that's not my pick, by the way. Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week. I just couldn't help thinking of the Fyre Festival.
I was just engaged in a hot Twitter debate, Leo, about how I'm going to be using this new iPhone XR smart battery case for Pokemon Go Fest, because an iPhone XR plus this battery case might just give me actual 8 hours of.
When is Pokemon Fest? Is it in Chicago?
You're literally juicing.
I don't know, because I think they did Chicago last time because they wanted to prove they could do it after the dismal failure the year before. So maybe
your own Fyre Festival.
They should do it in Montreal, I think.
They're doing the first one in Brazil this month, so we'll see how that goes. So my pick of the week is this is one of the devices that Apple worked on for the HomeKit launch at CES. It's not out yet, but I really like it. I'm going to mess up the name. It's Netatmo.
Netatmo, Netatmo. I like the
okay,
Netatmo.
There we
yeah,
go. Thank yeah. you. Thank goodness for you, Leo. So what's so interesting about this is that it really is a privacy-first doorbell. I'm going to call it a solution. It doesn't have any online component. You can put an SD card in it and record, I think, 2 days of video, and it'll keep recording over it if you don't pull it out and download it or something. Or you can choose to hook it up to your personal Dropbox account if you want to, you want to have it online.
That's a
good But there's
idea.
Nothing that goes up to any cloud that is not yours. It's designed to be quote unquote offline, you know, by design. but they also have a bunch of clever features in it. Like, it's got an accelerometer. So if someone tries to do something to it, like pull it off the wall, it starts just taking flash photos of the person so that you have some record of who did it. It does all these really cool sort of anti-tampering things. I got a chance to talk to them, and it's just so considerate, not just smart, but considerate the way they put it together, because they did realize that people wanted cameras, but they didn't necessarily want those cameras plugged into another company. So this is just, you buy this and that's the end of your relationship with Netatmo. It doesn't go any further than that. And if you want to buy another product, that's as far as that goes too. And I love, like, and you might love Nest, you might love Ring, you might love all those companies, but I always think it's important to have these kinds of options on the market as well.
Well, you know, we like those Wyze cams for the same reason. They don't, you don't pay a subscription fee, which is a reason everybody can get behind. But also the idea that, you know, your videos aren't stored somewhere that you don't control. I think that's kind of this after the Ring debacle. And I think this is, I might replace my Ring with this. This looks really good.
Yeah.
The next level is not having to. One level is trusting a company like Apple. The other level is I don't have to trust another company. Right. I know for a fact that this is not connected to anything else.
That's better. Yep.
I'm on the site right now and trying to figure out where to give them my money, because that's a great idea.
It doesn't look like you can.
This wonderful thing is like, because people will often say, how do you trust? How do you trust? I'm like, I do not trust any single company. I trust the technology behind AES encryption.
Yeah, well, trust that you can't trust. That's right. Yeah, that's fair. Well, I want to counter Jim's recommendation of rock and roll with a recommendation Andy will like. I just found a new streaming music service that focuses on classical music. This has always been, for me, an issue. I love, you know, all kinds of music. But classical music, while it is on Apple Music and in Spotify and everywhere else, often gets short shrift. And if you search for something, you're just as much going to find a pop song as a classical song. So, the other thing I like about this is there are different subscription levels depending on your bit rate. So the base bit rate is 320 kilobit MP3, which is fine. And that's fairly affordable, $8 a month or $80 a year. So it's a little bit less than Apple Music. But if you want lossless 24-bit FLAC streaming and you've got the right devices for it, $15 a month, $150 a year. So if you really care about audio quality and classical music, I think this is really interesting. And I've enjoyed it quite a bit. They have a 2-week free trial. I'm still deciding whether I'm going to end up ponying up the money or not. But I love the ability to just kind of stream quality classical music. I listen to it all the time. And I think this is an interesting play. Prime Phonic.
The problem of classical cataloging is so bad that that's one of the main reasons why I switched from iTunes to Plex. The ability to simply say that, yes, the ability to say that I'm interested in this recording of this opera because these two singers are singing on it. So please don't make me sort it by the orchestra and the conductor, because I will never remember either of those things.
Yeah.
And please don't. And please, when it comes up on my phone, I want to know that this is the second act aria from the title of the second act aria. I don't want to have to see Mozart colon the induction from the Seraglio colon conductor colon orchestra, and I have to wait 12 seconds to find out what track I'm listening to. So yeah, that sounds like a really great idea. That's a problem that needs to be solved.
This it does support AirPlay if you're on an Apple device. They have a Android version. I haven't checked to see if it supports Chromecast. Now that the Chromecast audio is dead, well, who cares? But no, I'm kidding. But it doesn't yet have a Sonos connection. Maybe it will. It's brand new, and the software is fairly new. And so I think, but so far so good. I'm really enjoying it. And I just often will have this on in the background. And one of the things I like is some of the playlists are really interesting. So it's called Prime Phonic. It's at primephonic.com. And you can try it free for 2 weeks. And I just thought I'd mention that, because you've got your rock and roll well represented. Now you've got your classical music. And now you've got MacBreak Weekly. Thank you, everybody. Jim, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Love you, Jim.
It's always good to be here.
Loopinsight.com, @Dalrymple. Anything you want to plug? Any podcasts or anything?
No, I didn't. No, I'm good. I just want to plug you. No, not like that.
Show title.
He's going to plug me.
Oh, no.
Thanks, Jim. Always great to see you. Mr. Andy Anacco, we know we catch you every week at WGBH Boston, Boston Public Radio, and the Material Podcast, all about Android on Relay.fm with somebody named Florence Ion.
Lovely Florence Ion. Yeah. She has so much wisdom and knowledge about Android and Google that she can actually do two shows a week about it, and I'm so glad to be doing that show with her.
Fantastic. Anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, also I've fixed the database problems on my blog, and so I'm now blogging again. So if you go to anacco.com, you will see it updated more than once every 4 months, which was when I was able to do it when I was having database problems.
We're going to move you to WordPress.com and you wouldn't have these problems.
I actually have established an account and a new URL on WordPress.com that is waiting for something, and I'm looking forward to not having to.
You're doing WordPress, but it's self-hosted.
I have a self-hosted one. I also have an account on WordPress.com that is not active. That's active, but not public yet. And so I've been using it long enough to know that, yes, it is much nicer than doing self-hosting.
Oh, because I self-hosted for a long time, and I remember those database problems, and I don't want to ever look at that again.
You know, I'm glad. It's like that vacation to that place where you get some beautiful pictures, but you have to really abuse yourself to get that place where you say that, I'm glad that I've done self-hosting. I learned a lot of valuable thing and has a lot of valuable experiences. I feel as though I'm a more experienced and wise person. Now I'm ready to never do that again.
Yes.
I need to put that on the bus ad. I will with me like
Impossible Andy 2.0 is my guess. On the record.
IHNATKO.com. And I like the new look. It's very pretty.
I'm working on it. I love the new WordPress
template. Yeah. Are you using Gutenberg yet to post?
Yes.
You like it?
Which is a hoot and a half. I'm still getting used to it, but I'm kind of liking it. I'm kind of liking how easy it is to make more structured and more interesting looking posts than the old one.
A lot of power.
I kind of miss the ability to sort of like push the easy button saying, yeah, can you just give me the HTML code right now, because I know exactly how to do the thing I want to do in HTML, and I don't know how Gutenberg wants me, what kind of a block I need to insert in this thing to make it happen. Good. So
Mars Edit still works, and Mars Edit's always a good way to post without too much fuss.
WordPress is a hell of a system. There's a new initiative, by the way, that's being backed by a whole bunch of people to create a new WordPress platform that's based on WordPress but also includes monetization that is designed for small newsrooms, not necessarily for one person blogger, but I'm talking about like local newspapers who have like as few as one and as many as a dozen people, where it's not just the CMS, it's also the optimization, it's also monetization, it's also getting memberships in, it's also getting subscriptions in, so that you can just hire to write the stuff and the business end will sort of like a QuickBooks for running a commercial web operation.
What's the name of that? Who's that?
Oh, I just read about it this morning. It was on the Neiman blog.
Okay.
From Harvard. I should probably make it a pick of the week next week. My first thing is, can I do it just as a one person who's not like a real newspaper? No. Okay. But yeah, it's just another testimony to how versatile and how solid WordPress is as a platform. If you're one person who just wants to post recipes, it's got you covered. If you are a newspaper supporting a community of 100,000 people, it's also got you covered. If you're scale up 10 times or 20 times that, it's also got you covered, and it's not terribly, so long as you don't host it yourself, it's not hard to use.
News Revenue Hub, and it's NewsPack, a new feature on WordPress.com. I will very definitely check that out. Anything that empowers journalism is
I really think we're starting to turn the corner now that we've got people who started off as whose careers as journalists started off in the internet age, so they don't have to, they can start a new business that's not based on classified ad revenue and on tire ads and on grocery ads that they're sure they're going to be getting every single day. we're starting to turn a corner where you've got that sort of awareness of here's how we can build this business. Here's how we can deliver news to the community, but also be able to pay people to do that, because the quality of the journalism goes up when you can actually make people that make people work full time on it instead of having to sort of squeeze it in. That's why on Instagram, that's why you, people are sort of fishing for, hey, give us a free hotel room and we'll blog about your thing. If you're make, if they're making enough money that they can pay for their own damn hotel rooms and buy their own tech products, you've got a certain level of insulation. And now we're seeing more sophisticated tools like this that say that we can not only it's not just about publishing, it's also about the business ends of things, and we can integrate that into WordPress in a way that will essentially make the thing run with less supervision than required before. I really think this is another indication that's turning the corner, that maybe you'll never be able to start a brand new newspaper print publication again, but the people who really want to continue to deliver news to Worcester, Massachusetts, Lowell, Massachusetts, and even be an alternative to the Boston Globe, you can absolutely totally do that without having to mortgage three houses.
Well, and credit to WordPress.com for doing this. That's great. One of the reasons we love having them as a sponsor.
No paid promotion for me, I'll say.
Rene Ritchie is, of course, at iMore.com, and his Vector podcast is a much listened to. In fact, you already got the DuckDuckGo story, I see.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Very good.
We had three ads. He had time to write 1,200 words and shoot a video.
Anything else you want to give a plug to, Rene?
No, I really like that video, the one that you see, Georgia, in the thumbnail, though, because I laid out some of the issues pertaining to government regulation, but also the fundamental right to remain private that I think we're all going to have to start discussing and grappling with. So if you have a chance to check it out, please let me know.
Something we talked about today, of course, yeah.
I don't have an answer, but I'd love to be part of the discussion.
Yeah, I think that's all anybody can say. We've got to be talking about this. And I do recommend that book, Surveillance Capitalism. It's on Audible if you want. It's really, it's long, but it's very profound, I think. And she's a deep thinker. I don't know yet whether I agree or disagree, but I think it's a really important part of the conversation she's talking about.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We do this show every Tuesday right after iOS Today, so you can make it a double Apple day if you want. Starting at 9 a.m. with iOS Today, and then at 11 a.m. with MacBreak Weekly. That's Pacific time, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. You can watch it live at twit.tv/live. If you do that, join the other folks watching live in our chat room, irc.twit.tv. You can go right there from your browser, and it's always fun in the chat room, 24/7, really. They're constantly, I don't know what they do for a living, but they're always, the same people, always in there. Do you ever sleep? You can also watch on-demand shows for everything we do. In this case, twit.tv/MBW. Or subscribe. That'd be my preference in your favorite podcast application. Just open it up and look for MacBreak Weekly. We've been around a while. I think you'll probably be able to find us pretty quickly. And don't forget your voice assistants, Guillermo, Shlomo, and Alyosha. In every case, you can just say, hey, Alyosha, or whatever. Listen to Twit Live to listen to the live stream, or play MacBreak Weekly podcast, and you'll get the most recent episode. That's an easy way to listen.
There's got to be a way we can monetize those three names. There's got to be a T-shirt design that will take advantage of this wonderful intellectual property that we've created here on Twit.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to make the show. That be the show name. So we'll start. Hey, thanks, everybody. Get back to work now, because break time, as the man said, is over. See you next time.